Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun, day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Dr. Everything be alright.
Hey, this is Erin Moran from A Girl Called Eddie, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
Do you enjoy the arts, have an interest in art classes and meeting your local creative community? Then join us at the Athens Cultural Center on the first Friday of each month from 5 to 7 p.m. View our latest exhibition over free nibbles and drinks hosted by our ACC board members, and get to know us. We are at 24 2nd Street in Athens and online at athensculturalcenter.org. We look forward to meeting you.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more, plus advance notice of close-up series conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Saugerties, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org. That's upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Ellen in Medusa, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Bernadette Hogan reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul is reviving her plan for affordable housing that failed in the legislature last year. Some critics said her ambitious housing proposal to build 800,000 new homes within 10 years was so big that it failed. But not enough is being done to actually build affordable housing locally or throughout the state. Zach Steinberg, Senior Vice President of Policy at Trade Association, the Real Estate Board of New York, said, and I quote, "We were creating about 20,000 units a year over the last couple of decades, and we think, based on looking at data from the Department of Buildings and Building Congress, is that we're on track for about 11,000 new housing units to get started this year," end quote. Steinberg blames the legislature for not renewing or replacing 421A, the now-expired incentive program that got developers to build affordable units. He says, and I quote, "The absence of this program has really led to a serious decline in the number of housing units we're creating," end quote. But some in the legislature disagree. State Senator Jabari Brisport said, and I quote, "I think we can do much better by directly having government invest in creating new affordable housing through, like, a social housing model," end quote. Almost everyone agrees that the lack of affordable housing is a major problem, both locally, where only in Hudson is there even a discussion about building affordable housing, and throughout the state. Spokesperson for Governor Hochul, Avi Small, said, and I quote, "Like 73% of New Yorkers, Governor Hochul believes housing affordability is a major problem. The housing crisis is pushing New Yorkers out of state to Connecticut and New Jersey that have built thousands more homes over the last decade than New York has," end quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Mid-Hudson News reports that members of the Dutchess County Conservative Party are upset with Republicans there for putting forth a proposal for the Dutchess County Legislature to increase their own salaries. The Republican majority approved a 68% pay raise at a recent meeting of the Dutchess County Legislature's Budget, Finance, and Personnel Committee. 9 Republicans and 1 Democrat voted for the large pay raises, while 3 Democrats voted against just days after the last election. Conservative Party Chair Don Minichino said, and I quote, "The same old political justifying comment by legislator Will Truitt that it'll attract good candidates is a load of you-know-what. It doesn't work that way, and history can prove it," end quote. Minichino then compared the Dutchess Republicans to Democrats in Albany who voted themselves a 29% raise recently. All the Republicans voting for the pay raise were previously endorsed by the Conservative Party. Read more about this story in Mid-Hudson News. The Altamont Enterprise reports that 10% of people in Albany County is considered food insecure, and 1 in 7 children go to school hungry, according to the Albany County Executive Dan McCoy. A press release from his office said, and I quote, "There are people in every community in Albany County that face food insecurity, from the hill towns to the suburbs to the cities," end quote. So the county recently announced $175,000 to the Regional Food Bank of Northeastern New York and its community partners of 40 food pantries and 16 soup kitchens in Albany County, and $75,000 to the United Way of the Greater Capital Region. In 2023, the Regional Food Bank provided 3.7 million meals to people in Albany County, but they say 1.4 million more meals are still needed. The new funding from Albany County will only provide an additional 400,000 meals, so at least another million are needed. McCoy said, and I quote, "Demand in Albany County for help has gone up 30% since last year, and we need to invest in programs that will make a difference. Strong partnerships will help reduce the meal gap this year from 26% to 18% by providing 464,167 more meals. This is only the beginning," end quote. Read more about this story in the Altamont Enterprise. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
I was just going to lie down for 5 minutes, take a little nap.
Yeah, a regular Rip Van Winkle.
Who?
Another guy who took a little nap, woke up and didn't know where he was.
Next, let's listen to 2023 new music from Columbia County percussionist, composer, jazz musician, and more, Bobby Previtt. This is Dark Current Mariner 2 on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Jean Thomas.
And I'm Tim Kenalty.
Welcome to Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We're talking again today to Christopher Williams, PRISM Coordinator for the Capital Region PRISM. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you for having me today.
So can you remind us what the acronym PRISM stands for and generally what your group does?
Hi, I'm Chris Williams from the Capital Region PRISM, a partnership for regional invasive species management. We're one of eight PRISMs in the state that are funded by the New York State DEC, and each PRISM has a different host. Thank you for having me today.
And again, PRISM stands for?
Partnership for Regional Invasive Species Management.
It's a test that we always do when you come by, right?
Yeah.
Make sure you remember the acronym. So you, one of the great things you do, and I know we were beneficiaries at the Land Conservancy, is you manage a lot of grants, and you do a lot of grant work with a lot of your partner organizations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. We have a host of deliverables that we fulfill for the New York State DEC. Education and outreach, early detection and rapid response, but we also coordinate efforts with our partners. And one of the ways we do that is we offer a request for proposals. Typically in December of each year, we will make an announcement that our funding window for applications is open, and we will have people apply for funds. Our requests for proposals are up to $25,000, and the purpose of them is to help assist partners with managing invasive species with projects that are tied to our annual work plan. And there is a host of proposals that have been completed over the last 5 years, and there's quite the range. But it's an opportunity for people to seek funding that doesn't require a match. And we are directly funded from the Environmental Protection Fund through the state. It needs to be aligned to our work plan that has justifications for the work that's being done.
And tell us about a really cool example of one that has recently got a grant that you're excited about.
Yes. We have a new partnership with the Grasslands Bird Trust in Fort Edward, New York. Washington County, New York has a bird wildlife management area. It's about an 18,000-acre parcel.
Wow.
And there are state lands there. And surrounding the outside of that are private preserves for those rare and endangered or species of concerns like the short-eared owl, the snowy owl. But the Bird Grassland Trust sought us out, and we had several meetings with some of their staff about how to prioritize and control invasives in some of the grasslands, they had noted that their bird counts were down. Mm. And it's hard to prove why a bird count is down, except for in this case, where the invasives are, the bird counts were down, and the parcels right next to it where the native sedges and grasses were, the bird counts were fine.
Huh.
So there's quite a strong correlation there. And they have a research proposal, but we're setting up research grids where they're going to do some selective herbicide treatment to get rid of thistles and knapweed.
Our favorites.
Yeah. And then there's some other treatments that they're going to do to get rid of reed canary grass. At the same time, post-treatment follow-up will be letting the native seed bank take over and then introducing new seed bank as a restoration project. And so there's some small parcels being to set up, so how these treatments will work. There's a lot of interest in this project because this knapweed is a threat to the actual state lands. And so the partnership for this, it's quite involved. There are state biologists involved, there's the PRISM, and then the Grassland Trust people. And so we're working together to initiate this pilot project. And I'm really excited.
It sounds very cool.
Yeah. And everybody's on board. So it's kind of like a win-win. Let's do this. There's a good volunteer base. So that's an example of a project. And we're funding all the equipment supplies. We've brought in consultants from Cornell to actually help with making decisions and how to set up like these parcels for studying. So there's quite an army of people involved in this little project.
So last time you were here, I think we asked you how you didn't get depressed, and I now understand how you're not depressed, because things like this give you a little hope, right?
Yeah, so we're actually applying science that's prescriptive in nature, and there's an outcome that we're expecting.
Very cool.
How many acres is it again?
The Grassland Bird Trust has two parcels that are around 80 acres, but it's part of a bigger complex for an ecological connectivity. The Fort Edward Grasslands, it's called, in Washington County, is around 18,000 acres that have been identified as critical habitat for certain species.
That's awesome. The difference you can make will be phenomenal.
Yeah, it's just a small project.
Great. Okay, last time you were here, we talked about invasive terrestrial plants and some aquatic. We're going to turn today to invasive animals and pathogens. Now, I notice that you have some of our arch enemies listed as tier 3 and 4, like jumping worms and emerald ash borer, Japanese beetles, hemlock woolly adelgid, and marmorated stink bugs, my favorite.
Ugh.
Does that mean we've already lost the battle to these pests? They have been here an awfully long time.
I would say no, we have not lost the battle. I would say that there are some species that have in certain specific cases. So I'd like to take a look at these as individuals and look at them individually and not holistically. Obviously, the emerald ash borer, that creature is fast moving. And so its spread throughout New York was rather quick. And it's unfortunate that we have the loss of the ash trees throughout New York. And I do see the damage. When I drive, I have family in Buffalo. I live in the Capital Region. When I do the drive, I see thousands and thousands of dead ash trees. So that's an unfortunate case. Learning lessons from that species and the transportation of firewood, which should not be done. We shouldn't be moving firewood around. There are measures that we can do in the future to help curb these infestations. Then on another scale, some of these other pestilence, like hemlock woolly adelgid, they don't move as fast, and the cold winters keep them at bay somewhat to buy time for biocontrol release. So, yeah, I like to look at all these forest pests and pathogens as what can we learn from them, and how can we use that information to hopefully do a better job in the future.
So where are we with emerald ash borer? I mean, I know I've lost hundreds on my property. Are we finding disease-resistant trees? Like, is there some hope for the future of the ash trees?
I would say yes, there's hope for the future. And why I would like to say that is I know that there's a couple programs out there where they are looking for some ash trees are resistant to the ash borer. I've read that, and I took a program once. It's like 1 in 1,000. So if you have like an ash stand and you know it got struck hard by the emerald ash borer, but there's a tree that didn't, that's worth maybe reporting. From a scientific perspective, it's nice to have a plot set up first and really monitor the mortality over time. So I know that there's somebody in state that's doing a project for that, a private group. And then I also know the federal government has been involved with basically collecting scions, branches mm-hmm. of the trees, and grafting them. So there's a program in place that could see the return of the ash tree. I just don't know if it'll be a cultivar or a hybrid, but I think that would take a really long time to have a tree that's resistant and then to reintroduce it to our it's going to take probably a lifetime.
It's like the disease-resistant elms that are just starting to come out,
yeah,
right?
And the chestnuts.
Yeah.
And it does. It takes decades and decades of research, but it's nice to know that we live in a period of time where these practices can be put in place to help preserve for future release again. So I think it's great. On the other hand is the emerald ash borer. The federal quarantine was lifted. They recognize that there's nothing they can do, and it's running its course, unfortunately, right now. I do recommend to landowners two things. If they have an ash stand with really good ash trees that are saw timber grade that could be harvested, there's economic value there, and they could seek out a harvest. And I always tell them, just turn around and use the funds to replant a new forest for regeneration. The other part is if your ash trees have been hit by the emerald ash borer, they're very dangerous to fell those trees. The interior of the tree, you know, the rot is not uniform throughout the tree. And when you fell a tree that's an ash tree that's dead, it doesn't fall like it would normally do. So they're a human health hazard after the fact. So that's why I kind of encourage people to remove their ash trees for a harvest before they get struck. But on the backside, not every homeowner has emerald ash borer. So again, don't be spreading and moving your infected trees around, because then you're just, you know, you might be causing an economic loss or a damage to a town or a park, a preserve, or a private landowner by inadvertently spreading it.
And if they're in a place that it's not danger to people, isn't it true that you'd want to leave some of the snags for wildlife as well?
Yeah, that is another recommendation, and that's one I do give. Like, you know, some of those birds will like those hollowed out trees for a habitat, but it might be with caution with saying that, because again, you get a windstorm and you're walking around in an ash stand of dead trees, that could be hazardous. So I got to throw that in there.
Right, absolutely.
Dead trees, those widow makers are not good.
Okay. Hemlocks. I adore hemlocks. They have such a wonderful history. And now these stinky, nasty, woolly adelgids are going on. What's the future with that?
I live in a place where the hemlock stands are 68% of the trees on the Adirondack Blue Line. The New York State Hemlock Initiative, led by Mark Whitmore, they have a biocontrol program. One of our partnerships with them through the New York State DEC is to identify infestations on the leading edge before it gets into the Adirondack Park, which we now know it is, but to encourage private and public landowners to do treatments on that leading edge. On the backside is releasing biocontrols to do studies to see if they're taking. So we're trying to buy time through managing identification and management, but it's hard over a large scale. There's a lot of parcels that are being taken care of, and there's some that's not. And the adelgid isn't found everywhere. You can go down to, like, you know, it's been in New York since 1980. You can go in the lower Hudson, you can go down around Ithaca and the southern tier, and you'll have dead hemlock stands. And then you can go just down the road and there's a thriving hemlock stand. So it's intermittent. It's not found everywhere. And there is mortality with really cold winters, except for the punctuated equilibrium problem, where the ones that did survive may be more cold tolerant. So
wait a minute, punctuated equilibrium.
I like that. That's one we've never heard.
I gotta write that down.
Yeah,
I think that's a biological term I learned back in college. That sometimes there's responses in the environment, and you know, organisms adapt really quickly and then have offspring that adjust to it. Think of a fruit fly. Think of these smaller, you know, high rates of reproductivity.
Right.
I'm not an expert in that field, but it's a cool word.
So there are some biocontrols for hemlock woolly adelgid that are out there now?
There are. The Hemlock Initiative, which is also funded through the state, through the New York State DEC, Mark Whitmore has done a good job. First, the adelgid that's been let loose here in New York is probably from Christmas tree stock that's been transported, and the species is native to Japan. So there is a natural predator in Japan that's been introduced. They call it Little Larry. It's a beetle, but it eats one of the generations of HWA. So there's two generations a year for HWA, and it is eating one of them. Now, it's not active when the adelgid has its second offspring are born. So there's a need for another predator. And so Mark Whitmore has gone to the Pacific Northwest, where hemlock trees exist with another hemlock woolly adelgid species. And they're trying to reintroduce that predator here in New York, and it's a silverfly, and there's two of them. There's a couple other predators I'm not fully aware of, but currently we're trying to get that silverfly to overwinter in this region, and hopefully that will take. The beetle is doing well. There is offspring, but it's not enough to prevent the loss. So it's biological control research and assessments in action, and it's kind of neat. So and then the slow moving of the adelgid is buying us the time, and the cold winters do help.
Oh, so it's a good combo platter then, that there's actually this research and it's not moving as quickly as some of the others.
Yeah, so it's a nice compare and contrasting to the emerald ash borer, because that little guy can fly.
So quickly, yeah.
Yeah, where the adelgid's slow moving.
I like Little Larry.
I like Little Larry. Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It was pretty much a draw. I mean, they didn't get what they wanted, we didn't get what we wanted, and you know, just when you change the rules, it's hard to win.
Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville is releasing almost all of the military promotions he's had blocked for 10 months. The hold was a protest over the Pentagon's abortion policy, which remains unchanged. After the Republican made his announcement, the Senate swiftly confirmed 425 nominees. It continues to block the promotion of 11 four-star generals. While talking about the House Republican agenda, Speaker Mike Johnson said the White House has been stonewalling their impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden. He defended their investigation as the opposite of the sham impeachments Democrats brought against former President Donald Trump.
You're seeing a very deliberate investigation, uncovering and following the facts, following the truth where it leads. That's what the Constitution requires the House to do.
Johnson says a vote to continue the inquiry will be coming soon. The administration's $110 billion foreign aid package looks stalled in a sharply divided Senate, with recriminations from both sides. Republicans are demanding a House amendment to toughen border policy be included with the aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is against it being part of the funding package.
Many Republican members say they want to do Ukraine. If they themselves can't put a border amendment that would pass, then what the heck are we doing?
Schumer says more does need to be done to protect the border, but says Republicans should put forward a standalone bill, which could gain bipartisan support. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says they'll filibuster the entire package if it's not included.
I'm advocating, and I hope all of our members vote no on the motion to proceed to the shell, to make the point, hopefully for the final time, that we insist on meaningful changes to the border.
Immigrant rights groups oppose the House plan because it would in many cases ban asylum and create barriers for migrants seeking it. Constanza Segovia with Hartford Deportation Defense is calling on Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy to stand against it, arguing the right to asylum shouldn't be negotiable.
Hopefully, we think that we can get Senator Murphy to stand strong and not bargain these key policies.
College presidents testified before a congressional committee about the rise in anti-Semitism on campus since the start of the Israel-Hamas war. Harvard President Claudine Gay says they have to walk a line, confronting hate while protecting free expression, even for hate speech.
But when that expression crosses into conduct that violates our policies around bullying, harassment, intimidation, threats...
New York Governor Kathy Hochul has wasted no time calling for a special election February 13th to replace disgraced former Representative George Santos. Nassau County's Democrat and Republican leaders vowed to implement a vigorous screening process for those who will run. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A North Florida congressional district map which diluted black voting power was upheld by a Florida appeals court December 1st. The 10-judge panel ruled that plaintiffs didn't prove the map violated Florida's constitutional amendment prohibiting racial gerrymandering. The new map was manipulated to spread the former Congressional District 5's black voters among four separate districts, keeping three-term Congressman Al Lawson from being reelected and black voters in North Florida from electing the candidate of their choice. Republicans argue that the larger former district was not geographically compact and constituents didn't have common interests. In 2010, Florida voters passed constitutional amendments intended to require fairness in redistricting, including for minority citizens. In part, it reads, "Districts shall not be drawn to deny racial or language minorities the equal opportunity to participate in the political process and elect the representatives of their choice." Then-Governor Rick Scott slow-walked implementation, and courts ultimately drew the maps in 2015. After the 2022 Florida House Redistricting Commission's maps were seen as too competitive by Governor Ron DeSantis, he vetoed the legislature's version and strong-armed his own congressional map into place. Democracy groups have already filed a notice of appeal to the Florida Supreme Court. A decision is expected by March. We have more on District 5 and the groups taking action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Agitpop was an art punk band from Poughkeepsie, formed in 1981 with albums on Twin Tone, Rough Trade, and other labels. Here is Poughkeepsie's Agitpop with On the Hudson on the radio at WGXC.
There's a river
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Sometimes I like to say that I grew up with a Jewish mom and a musician dad, and so I became a Jewish musician.
Un Frühling trägt lichtig grün, die Bäume schwer mit Blumen. Und Gott hat einen neuen Schein, von neuen weißen Wolken.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm sitting here with singer-songwriter and klezmer musician Ada Hetko, originally from the Capital Region.
I started writing songs when I was tiny. I was around a lot of music constantly and also around songwriters. There's a wonderful Capital District songwriter, Roseanne Ranieri, who my dad is good friends with. And as a toddler, I was around Roseanne and my dad practicing songs that Roseanne wrote. And I remember very early thinking, I want to be a songwriter when I grow up.
So Ada, my first question, how would you describe klezmer music?
Klezmer music is party music for dancing that came from Eastern Europe and has been shaped by having a life in the United States also.
And the song that we just heard, God Has a New Sewing Machine, I believe is the English translation. Is that an example of klezmer music?
Great question. So I would call that Yiddish song more than klezmer music, but the history of Yiddish song and klezmer is generally considered to be like the core repertoire of klezmer is generally instrumental music, and Yiddish song usually has lyrics, but there are also klezmer songs that have lyrics, and there's a lot of klezmer instrumental style that's used in Yiddish song performance. So there's a lot of overlap, and there's also a lot of overlap with Yiddish folk song and synagogue music. So there's a lot of interplay between all of these different types of music.
So you now live in Boston. And you also describe yourself as a Yiddish culture maker. Sounds very interesting. Can you Tell us what that means.
Yeah, I do a lot of different things in the Yiddish cultural world. I've taught Yiddish language classes. I've supported Yiddish language programs in different ways. I teach Yiddish singing. I teach Yiddish dance and do a lot of dance leading. I do Yiddish translation. So it's not just that I plug in one particular way as a singer-songwriter, even though that's the thing that I probably spend the most time at. I'm doing lots of different work from different angles to support the Yiddish culture scene and help it grow. And part of that is like making connections between people, being mentored by people, mentoring people, getting people connected, and helping make the culture happen.
You know, last June, I don't know if you're familiar with Old Songs Music Festival. I was on the contra dance floor and a dance ended. And I found myself standing next to this young woman wearing a T-shirt, and it looked like it had Yiddish words on it. And I was so intrigued. You know, we started talking and she told me about her involvement in Yiddish language classes, Klez Canada, which I know you're familiar with. It's an organization that fosters Jewish cultural and artistic creativity. But I was so intrigued that a young person would have this connection and strong interest in Yiddish.
Yeah, a lot of young people are interested in Yiddish, and it's not a new thing. There's a joke in the Yiddish cultural scene that every 5 years there's an article that comes out that says, oh, suddenly people are interested in Yiddish. So it's not not at all a new thing. I think a lot of people of my generation and younger, I'm 32, and I've been involved in the Yiddish culture world for about 10 years. And I think a lot of people in their 20s and 30s are coming to Yiddish culture with a lot of curiosity and a strong sense of connection that doesn't have the baggage of previous generations. Like, we don't have the same sort of assimilationist pressures. We don't have the sense of shame that some people feel connected to Yiddish. And the story that is so commonly heard about people in their 70s and 80s and also sometimes their 60s saying, oh, my parents spoke Yiddish, but they didn't teach it to us, and they used it as a secret language when we weren't around. Like, we don't have that sort of baggage. So there's a certain amount of playfulness and freedom that we have that's really special. And there's also, because Yiddish isn't, there are Yiddish institutions, but because Yiddish isn't institutionalized the same way that many other languages and cultures are, that also gives a certain amount of freedom to take ownership, to like learn all that you can and then take ownership of it and make something new.
Fascinating. What do you especially value about Yiddish culture, music, the language? I know that's a big question.
One thing that I especially value is the particular relationships that I have within the scene. That was really what kept me in it. Like, I came to my first Klezmer Festival. I came to Klez Camp in 2013, and I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know any Yiddish, and I didn't know any Yiddish songs. I really didn't. Okay, I knew Tumba Laika. I was like, you know, just curious. And I was scooped up by some really lovely, warm people, like Jeff Warshauer, who's a wonderful guitarist and singer, and Ethel Rehm, who's a fabulous, fabulous Balkan singer and Yiddish singer. I was just sort of taken in by some really wonderful, really talented people. And that was really exciting. And I was also excited by the intellectual challenge of learning about a new culture, learning a new language, and learning how to make art in that language. It's hard, so that's exciting.
It doesn't get boring, it sounds.
Right. It often feels like there's just another door opening and another door opening and another door opening, because a language is an entire world. So there's so much to explore.
So going back to your song at the beginning of this piece, God has a new sewing machine. What actually is the Yiddish for that title?
Gott hat a neue Nähmaschine.
Is there a storyline, a message to the piece, or is it just a fun piece?
Ooh, that's it.
Or both.
That's a juicy question. Is there a message? There's definitely a storyline, because the first verse is describing it's springtime and it's beautiful and there are flowers. And then the second verse is saying that it's dusty and boots are getting the thresholds all dusty. And there's no rainbow because there's no rain. And then this is the setup for the third verse. The duck is happy and will get happier because there's going to be a rainbow because God has decided to sow rain. So that's the story in the song. And I have to say, one of the most joyous moments of my songwriting career so far, my partner is a choir director, among other things, and one of the community choirs that he directs is an intergenerational choir. It's mostly families, parents and small children. And he wrote an arrangement of that song to be sung by the choir. And oh, it was so fun to watch the kids. They were very excited about singing the word schmutz. That was a big draw for them. But it was very cute. It was very nice. Like, that's what I want to do with my songs. I want them to be something that people can sing and love and take with them.
So fun, and you know, the rainbow comes out, a joyful experience, one of happiness, excitement, exhilaration.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not that all of my songs are happy, but I find deep joy in being able to write Yiddish songs, and I want to share that joy with other people. And klezmer music, here we're getting back to the connection between klezmer and Yiddish song. Klezmer music is party music. So there's a very deep joy in klezmer. And I think there's a real purposefulness to the joy in both Yiddish song and klezmer, that we're doing something serious with that joy. We're bringing communities together. We're doing something positive, building a positive Jewish identity. We're doing real work.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Blue is the frequency from the Royal Trucks.